29. And in the fireside room this afternoon, Jennifer McCrickert will be talking about technology and ethics. That's part of our series. And today it's Ethics and Computers. This is tape number 99-4. And now let's join Jennifer in the fireside room.
And try not to kill myself. Okay, why don't I get started? No. my name is Jennifer McCrickert, and this is a technology and ethics series. And today we are going to be talking about computers and ethics. I teach philosophy at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. My area of specialty is ethics. And I've recently gotten interested in technology for a bunch of different reasons. And one of them is that most people who are not academic philosophers are really interested in ethical issues that come up with technology. They tend to not be very interested in a lot of the other ethical issues because they're not very sexy. But technology, it's a sexy topic. So today, what I'd like to talk about are the ethical issues that come up with computers. I think this is especially interesting as January 1st of the year 2000 approaches and people are getting more and more afraid of the entire world just coming to a grinding halt, which I think would be kind of fun just to see how everybody reacts. Sort of have a perverse sense of humor. On the first day of this series, I talked about the Industrial Revolution and all of the different technologies that were introduced in the late 19th century. And I don't think it's a huge stretch to talk about the computer revolution as having a very similar effect in the late 20th century. The introduction of computers has dramatically changed society. It's changed work. It's changed communication. It's changed education. It's changed how we distribute information. And there are lots of things positively and negatively. That there are lots of people who see the introduction of computers as just a horrible thing. Other people see it as something that has actually helped a huge number of people. There's probably lots of stuff on both sides. The other thing that I'm very interested in with computers, and this is because as a philosopher and having the perverse sense of humor that I do, like to push people and really push them to their limits, is I'm interested in the concepts of both artificial intelligence and artificial life, and just what those things do to our concepts of what's moral and what's immoral, what sorts of beings do we have some sort of ethical regard for, because if we can create computers that have intelligence, what sorts of obligations do we now have to these things? If we can create artificial life, see, people are already laughing. If we can create artificial life, if we take stuff that's going on in the environmental movement seriously, that all life has value. It doesn't matter if it's sentient life or if it's able to think. And if we can create life on computers, that has some interesting ethical implications. It at least pushes us. And what I think both artificial intelligence and artificial life push us to do is really figure out what we mean by intelligence, what we mean by what sorts of things have rights. Because I think that it's very easy for us to glibly say, well, I have rights, you have rights. We really don't need, there's not much of a question. But if we can get into those gray areas, do things like Data on Star Trek have rights? It helps us to figure out what really is necessary for rights. I say people just aghast already, stunned looks. But if you can find out whether or not, okay, tell me what you're all thinking.
Gretchen says he does. He does have rights.
Well, see, there we go.
Court of law.
What?
It was decided on the show.
Oh, that's right. We know that all decisions made on television are by definition going to be
Picard.
We don't want to contradict Picard. That's right. But what I think it does do, and I use Star Trek episodes, and if machines could have rights, to get into questions like abortion and euthanasia. Because if we can figure out under what circumstances a robot might have rights or a gorilla might have rights, then that helps us figure out, well, does a fetus have rights? So if you look at these sort of fantastic examples, which are becoming less and less fantastic because they're looking as if they're more and more possible, it helps us to clarify what we mean by these terms. So I'm going to try and hit on all of these. And artificial life is something that I've actually just found out about in the last year. And what it helps, and I think that talking about artificial life helps us figure out what exactly do we mean by life. And most of the authors I have read talk about how our definitions of life are very carbon-centric, that the only example we have of life... Welcome to the PC world. Pun intended. The only example we have of life is life on this earth. And so we tend to think that, well, for something to be alive, it must have all of the characteristics of things that are alive on this earth. But it could be that all living things on this earth have certain characteristics that are universal for all living things on this earth, but aren't really necessary for life. Does that make sense? Okay, let me see if I can think of an example. Well, one example would be all living things on Earth. This really isn't even true, but we'll just take it for the sake of argument. Actually breathe, that there's some sort of respiration going on. And we tend to think as if respiration is necessary for life. But it could be that all of these things are alive, and it just so happens that they also breathe. And it also may just so happen that they're all brown. But their brownness may not be necessary for them to be alive. Does that make sense? So questions of artificial life. Can we create things on computers that are alive really pushes us to say, well, what do we really mean by life? And if we could create things on computers that are alive, what sorts of obligations might we have towards them? And what I'm actually more interested in are the scientists who are working on these things. Because my sense is that I actually have friends who are neuroscientists and who are computer scientists. And they just think it's really cool to try and create these things. And I, as an ethicist, well, wait a minute. You're creating these things that could be intelligent, that could be alive. This is your goal. And it seems to me that if you're going to be creating something that could be intelligent, you may want to think a little bit about what you're creating before you create it. In the same way that people who have children, I think that a little bit of thought ought to go into having the child, just so you that you might have should. I'm not saying it all does, but that you should have some sort of thoughts about that you're bringing something into the world. And people who work in artificial intelligence, that seems to get largely left out. That we're trying to bring something that's intelligent into the world. Well, what happens if we actually do this? What sorts of responsibilities do we have? So those are that's a wide range of things. There are huge things going on in computers right now. But what are some of the changes that you have noticed in the world because of computers in terms of work, communication, information distribution, education, etc.?
Kind of being more male. In the mailbox.
And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
A bad thing. I mean, I like getting email and I like sending it, and I don't get a lot. I mean, I don't send a lot, and I get some, but I'd rather get that than nothing. But I really miss writing myself and getting mail. It's a totally different aesthetic.
You don't get tons of junk mail?
No, I think she means personal letters.
Yeah.
Personal letters.
Yeah, okay.
And it seems like that might be gone forever, which seems unfathomable to me because letters in my life have been really important, both giving and getting, you know, writing and giving.
That puts Holden in a very unique situation too, because as a computer support person, I have to communicate with other computer companies, and sending them a letter just does not.
They don't know how to deal with it, huh?
Saying I can't, but I'll know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Who are you?
Just go to this website. No, you don't understand.
Diane? A couple of thoughts as you're talking about that. Is thinking about creating artificial intelligence, is that a lot different than what Mary Shelley talked about in Frankenstein? You know, the responsibility of creating that creature.
No, it actually isn't all that different.
And the other thing is, having worked in the computer industry for years, I think one of the things that I've seen is it was supposed to be paperless. It wasn't. We created more paper and more reports. And I think a lot of management now suffers from information overload because it is possible to put information together in 1,400 different ways. And I'm not sure we are, in some areas, a lot more effective or anything. I think sometimes we really do have too much information for the decisions we have to make just because it's doable with the computers.
Too much data.
What?
Maybe too much data but not enough information.
Too much data but not enough information, okay.
And just to touch on the word effective that you used, I think that the immediacy and the speed, I think people are making snap decisions and then having to go back, and I think there's a lot of redoing that wasn't there before because you had time to think on the way to a meeting. And now you're on the way to a meeting and you're on the phone and decisions are coming and there's a lot of haste.
Plus, I think sometimes people have more faith in the information they're given, the data they're given, than they should. Mm-hmm. I've watched enough user-friendly programming to know how easy it is to mess up the parameters you feed into the machine and think you're getting this information and you're getting something very different.
So you all are mostly talking about computers that humans directly interact with.
Yes, I am.
Because the main concern in terms of things like the Y2K bug, I mean, that's the least of our problems. I mean, my personal PC, I mean, I can just keep rotating the date back, and I won't have a problem. The big concern that everybody has is just the ways in which computers are basically running everything these days. But the argument for that is that it actually is far more cost-effective, it is far more efficient, and lots of horrible jobs that people, I mean, were just mind-numbingly boring jobs. There was, I mean, very little job satisfaction are now gone because the computer can take care of it. I mean, so one of the arguments for computers, and this isn't so much the personal computers, is that by relying upon computers, things actually go far more efficiently. Things are now decentralized in a way that they never were before because people in smaller groups can start to make decisions, and they don't have to all be in the same place with a boss making all of this, all of the decisions. What are your thoughts about those arguments for computers and those? And are there any ethical issues that come up there in terms of our dependence upon computers in the job?
One thing that comes to my mind is it's like through time, jobs that were needed have changed. I mean, there's not too much call for buggy whip making anymore. The carriage making. I mean, that went away. Now there's all these tasks that computers are going to get rid of. I think it's just going to be a continuation of the process, but we'll make this accelerating.
Is that a bad thing or a good thing?
Well, has it ever been a bad thing? I mean, probably. For the people who are affected. But what concerns me more and more is the speed at which things are changing. It's like, nowadays, I mean, it used to be if you learned a profession, there was no chance that the profession was going to completely go away in your lifetime. Nowadays, you could go through two or three professions and have each one of them kind of basically go by the wayside. Or changed so much that you can't, it's not even recognizable.
Right. So. You definitely have to be learning on the job constantly. You can't just stagnate. Jim?
Just a couple comments about computers doing the kind of macro stuff or the behind-the-scenes stuff. I think most of the time, it's probably just fine. I'd probably rather have a computer tracking planes in the sky and giving the aircraft controller instructions about what to tell the pilots in terms of keeping a safe distance than relying on an aircraft or on an air traffic controller to do that visually after 12 hours at the terminal. So I think, and the record seems to indicate that seems to be working pretty well. But on the other hand, there are a lot of communities that have been redlined by banks. And how do you get that? Well, it's a theory, and it's not the computer doing it. Of course, it's the programmer and the program that computer to say, if the assets are below this, draw a line through it. And the other, that's a concern where you just sort of have automatic decisions. I mean, there are a lot of farmers whose banks get bought by bigger banks, and they've been going into that place for years dealing with a local banker. They know him by face and by name, and all of a sudden they can't get the loan they need to put the crop in because there's some central computer in Omaha that says, sorry, but you owe us too much and your collateral is too little. You're out of luck. So, and that's my final, my last comment is that yes, they make us extraordinarily efficient, but I'm not sure that we will be the culture or the civilization we want to be if efficiency becomes our cardinal value.
The computers themselves obviously are not evil, but some of the things we do with them.
The one sitting on my desk frequently is.
it was really scary to me, one of the jobs I interviewed for in Scottsdale, Arizona, pharmaceutical card systems, I think it was. I don't know if you guys know what happens to the information when you get a prescription filled. Mm-hmm. That was really frightening to me, that if I had taken a job with this company, I would be, from all of the pharmacies around the country, finding out if this doctor was prescribing more Prozac or Paxil, and which people were taking it. I mean, I know that somebody can find out exactly what medicines I am taking, and that is real frightening to me. The other thing is, my girlfriend quit using credit cards the year she got her statement back at the end of the year, and it told exactly how much she had spent. She said that was the end for her, exactly how much she spent on airline travel, eating out, that's scary to me, that somebody can know that much using computer data.
So there are two issues here, just in terms of, one in terms of what sort of society should we have, and what sort of values. And that the focus on computers seems to push us more towards efficiency, which, in response to the frequent criticism that computers are going to be taking up more and more jobs, what people have usually responded with is, "Well, see, we'll have so much more time for leisure." Well, exactly, and so that's a crucial problem. Is that typically what is that?
Yeah, so much more time for unemployment.
Yes, it would also. Well, if you think of it that way.
Well, there are jobs that are available now. I mean, you see that there are more jobs available, supposedly. Sometimes I read that. But they aren't jobs that the average person, like myself, I mean, I am so computer illiterate, I don't even know what words you're using half the time.
Well, that was sort of my point, is that, even if you did know about computers, you might, 10 years from now, you might not know anything about the type of, whatever was being done then.
Yeah, and computers changed too. I got an Apple in, I think it was in 80. Well, Apple is practically past 80 now. Now I have two computers because I still have the old Apple and I have another one.
Go ahead.
Well, I think it's interesting, all of the technology that we've talked about so far, there are great things that can be done with the technology, and it's, it's us, probably some of the people in this room that are deciding how the technology is going to be used. And it can be used for great things or it can be used for less than great things. Yeah. And that's what we really need to focus on, I think, is I think it's interesting, I hadn't really looked at the ethical side of it, and I think that really is a very important aspect of it.
And tomorrow morning, we'll be talking about how do we choose technologies and who should be doing the choosing. So I'm not going to just leave you hanging here with all these. And the other issue that's come up now is the privacy issue. And that's been huge with computers and the internet. Basically, any sort of information that anybody could possibly want about you is most likely can be found on the internet. Or it's in somebody's computer bank somewhere. And what's interesting about this is that the law, I mean, most of the stuff that's on the internet is public record. But, I mean, there's lots of information. There's something that I read about 3 months ago where some DMV, some motor vehicles department was going to be selling people's photo IDs with their name and their phone number. Now, there are no laws prohibiting this. It is
in Oregon. The motor vehicle database was online. So you could look up somebody's.
Right.
I know the license number. You could look up the owner, the address.
That's because it's because it's all public record. Because if I wanted to, I could go down to City Hall and I could look up a huge amount of information, but it would take me a whole lot of time. I'd have to probably pay some sort of nominal fee to do it, and I'd have to flip through dusty books. So people really didn't do it, even though it was perfectly legal to do so. What the internet has done is it hasn't changed the law at all, but it's made things far more accessible. And I think that lots of people get very bothered by this, and it's hard to get a hold of because before, I mean, it's not that things are, in some sense, any more available. It's always been public record. But it's just that now I can sit in my study and I can access this information. Or, I mean, and the company that was going to be selling IDs, it was for a very noble purpose. It was to check people who were coming in and they were writing checks so they could pull up your picture immediately and they wouldn't have to bother you for the driver's license. They could just pull it up, see who you were, and they'd be okay with it. Do you think that there should be more laws that are regulating this sort of stuff?
If so, could they be really effective? If there were
you implement the law?
Yeah.
It would probably depend. But you probably could, because most of the information would be coming from some sort of government institution or coming from some sort of corporation. And corporations have a huge incentive to follow the really obvious laws or to blatantly follow those sorts of laws.
Well, in South Dakota, our driver's license is our Social Security number, and that's not a good thing.
Yeah, lots of states are going to that.
Somebody gets a hold of your Social Security number, they can cause you a lot of problems.
That's another thing I noticed just in business applications. I've never worked with artificial intelligence or anything, but in business applications, the first human resource package I put in for U-Haul was like about 20 years ago. And there was a big debate about what is your personal ID number. And the software package was actually set up to use your Social Security number. But U-Haul wanted to come up with some sort of artificial number and finally went with Social Security number. By the time, just like 4 years ago, everybody was using Social Security number. I don't think there is a human resources system in the country that isn't run by Social Security number.
And there was a big argument against the whole Social Security number system mm-hmm. at the very beginning, just in terms of concerns of privacy.
Just to add on to that, we just got a note from the IRS last week that said that the credit we had claimed for Sophia, we now had to pay back because she didn't have a Social Security number yet. Because I thought, we were in the hospital and we thought, why does a baby, there's too much prying already in our lives, we'll wait till she needs it. Well, there you go.
They tell
you. Are there any social justice issues that come up with computer use?
Sure.
And our reliance access, on computers?
Access, affordability.
Can you expand upon that?
If you have wealthier parents and they're willing to buy a computer, you have access to the internet, or you have access to educational software. If you're in a wealthier school district and that's how it works, you may have access to better technology, or you may have access to more advanced computer technologies. Whether you then have teachers that know how to use them well to facilitate your learning is a different question, but still, odds are that in an information age, those who have more financially are probably in a better position to be able to learn how to use these technologies.
There's probably a rural versus
rural versus
high speed connection throughout the country.
And there is the social stigma attached to that now as well in school. Kids in our school begin formal, it's not an office skill, it's a life skill, they say, being able to keyboard, but to learn basic software, to learn productivity software, et cetera. Some kids come to school knowing it already, and they just, they go on to learn some of the niftier, more arcane stuff. Some kids haven't seen it until they get there, and they're frankly embarrassed about it. And there's a lot of posturing, sort of deception, pretending that they know what's going on. And there's a lot of vandalism. Kids that get so frustrated because they're so far behind, that they just either refuse to do it or they steal a ball out of the mouse.
I didn't even know you could do that.
There were frustrations probably similar to that, when one would come to school of knowing how to read and others hadn't seen the letter.
The thing that computers make possible, though, is that that it is very possible to pursue your skill as an individual. That they're wonderful for individualized instruction. And a teacher that's alert to that, that has more than one computer in the room, can easily arrange for a student to practice and get up to speed without sort of the stigma of falling behind a class is all taken away.
I can give you an interesting thing about that. After I got my computer, somehow or other, I learned how to program some. And I programmed some. I was always interested in English and proper English. And so I programmed homonyms and other words that were very similar. Well, like the two and two, and the were, where, where, and how to use them correctly, because kids often have a lot of trouble. So what I did is I'd make sentences and with a blank in them, and which, well, first of all, I would tell them how to use these words. And then I would make these sentences with blanks in them, and they would answer them. I'd give them a set of 20 sentences. And then my kids wanted to know what grade did we get, so I put a grade on there, too. But anyway, after they had done these, the first 20, they'd go to the second 20, up to 100, and I figured if they didn't know it by the time they got to 100, they could start over, they wouldn't remember anyway. But anyway, I gave it to teachers in Arizona when I was down there, and the department, the kids that, you know, that need special help, special ed department, the teacher would give them the opportunity to use the computer if they did things, as a privilege. Well, so one of them would use this, and he went back to class, and when they had a test, he got better than most of the kids in the class, and was he excited. So, there is learning to it.
I think that it can be very effective for learning with the right sorts of programs and stuff like that. One thing that I've been struggling with, and then I'm going to shift to artificial intelligence in a moment, is I just got back from Nicaragua, and we went to a base Christian community where there were lots of educational things going on, and they had a brand new room that had been paid for, I think, by the Canadian government, that was filled with top-of-the-line computers. I mean, better computers than I think I've ever seen. And so one of the things I've been struggling with trying to figure out is computer technology, is that going to be better at bringing together both the industrialized countries and the not-industrialized countries or the developing countries? Or will computer technology serve to further widen the gap between the two? And that's something that I'm really struggling with. And I was just so surprised as I walked in and saw that. I mean, this community center was teaching kids who were from a very poor background. But they had access to the internet. They had access to all this computer technology.
Was that the exception that proves the rule, though?
I've never understood that saying. So
okay, well, basically, it stands out so much because it just doesn't happen that way. No?
Well, there was computers. We went to a small community on the Atlantic coast. Which is a very rural community, and they had I think two computers. They had one in the school and they had one in a health center, which gave them connections to a bunch of other places that they otherwise wouldn't have had. So it probably, I mean, certainly it is not the case that the entire country is filled with computers. I mean, it's incredible.
Like, what percentage of the population has access?
Oh, staggeringly low. I mean, it would be staggeringly low.
That's what I mean by it's like, very few people have access to that particular center, and there aren't that many other centers. So,
there are world events that have happened that we would not have known about otherwise, like Tiananmen Square. We wouldn't have gotten much news on that at all if it weren't for email communication and computers in those countries, even though they in China, there are quite a few computers. But in other
China's gearing up.
Oh, it's incredible. Biggest market out there, next to Japan. But other areas of the world, we would not have that kind of information and that kind of access without being able to send email back and forth.
If it was the computers that let us know when they were tearing down the statues in Red Square, everybody's surprised that we hadn't pulled the plugs on this building, but the people that were in the building were sending messages out to all the world on their computers. This is what's happening.
So in that way, it serves to connect us.
Mm-hmm.
I think, talking about the market, I think, at least for the time being, it's being driven by an enormous expectation of massive profits by those who are making these. And right now, they have us all by the nose, because we all believe it's urgent, it's inevitable, and that you have to have one. And if that results in government agencies and aid agencies selling and setting up computers in the belief, maybe a legitimate belief, but maybe a mistaken one, that this really will benefit. As long as there's an expectation of these profits, I think it will continue. But if that disappears, if all of a sudden the market is saturated and the projections say, well, we won't be able to sell anymore, I think it'll dry up pretty fast.
I suspect that computers will continue to get faster. And I mean,
that's one of the things that bothers me. It's like Karen and her stereo. You heard that story the other night. I mean, once you get one, we do business with a little Apple computer that's about 20 generations old, and customers laugh at it when they come in. And one guy said, I'm going to write an article about this place that does business with this ancient computer. Well, all we need it for is to hold our inventory that we take off every day, and then I know what to order. But you get one computer like we did 2 or 3 years ago, and now the latest one is Jim Martin Schramm telling us we can't possibly exist with that computer, but you know, it has to be faster. Gosh, you wait 2 minutes to get online or whatever that is. So, and then you get a newer one, and then you've got to get a bigger one, and it's just insatiable. I mean, it just bothers me.
But it is working the other way. There are a lot of small companies recognizing that nobody wants the whole thing. They want to just get on the internet and send an email. And eMachine is developing, they're selling $400 computers that can do everything your $2,000 computer can do.
Yeah. Yeah, because most of us, we have so much stuff on our computers and we use it as either glorified typewriters or as just a means to get to the internet. And you don't need much at all in terms of computer technology to do that. And, I mean, and I think, in fact, there are some programs where some not not computer programs, but systems set up where you can plug your computer into the internet, and then different places all around the world can access all of the unused stuff in your computer, and it can be used while you aren't using it. So you can donate your computer because it's just sitting there and it's not getting anything done, and it's not, I mean, it's basically wasted energy. So you can be onto the internet and all these other things could be using your computer.
Also, there are like
institutions
that are that basically offer on the internet. So you, people volunteer and go out and use their computer and download a part of a problem.
Yeah.
And they sit there and use their extra cycles to compute on this problem and put together with a
massive 100,000
computers. Yeah, it's massive parallel processing.
Well, and they already do it. They are trying to load a cookie onto your machine once you register. It doesn't use its database to keep your information on it. It uses yours. And they control it and operate it from...
Why don't you explain that, sir? But I know what you're talking about. I know what a cookie is.
You guys are using the cone of silence, right? Well, they put
a little when you register for a magazine or receive something, that what you do is you put your email address in, and they have a connection to your machine. Right? And you could say more about this, but they put in your hard drive in a little file they create what is known as a cookie. But that is just a little information that they can use and access when you log into their machine.
So they can tell who you are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they can automatically say, hello, Jennifer Cooker.
Are you talking about this subscribing to things?
Yeah.
That way, next time you go there, they'll pop up the all the things that you've already.
Your computer sends them all the
interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you'll see ads telling you about where to go buy all these things.
They create a profile on who you are and what you like and send that stuff towards you.
Every time I go to Amazon.com, they have a whole list of books that they think I'll like based on all of the books I've bought in the past.
They often
I'll get that one. Well, as I talk with my students about this stuff, they very quickly get to the point that I haven't, just by looking at your faces, some of you are getting to, which is, oh my gosh, computers are taking over the world. And my students then very quickly, because they've watched a lot of science fiction, become concerned about the time where computers will actually be able to move around and think for themselves. Now, we already know that Gretchen thinks that computers do have rights and are persons.
Data.
Well, data is a computer, therefore it is the case that some computers have rights and are persons. What do the rest of you think about the possibility that computers could be persons or could have rights?
You know, it's funny. One thing I've always experienced with artificial intelligence is you never ever see artificial intelligence actually implemented. By the time it's implemented and in something, it's just a computer program. It's no longer artificial intelligence.
Did you not see that chess game?
Yeah.
Where
Big Blue versus Garry Kasparov? Beat him.
It's a program. It's not artificial.
Yeah, well, then it ran around the room with its hands in the air.
What did you say?
What are you imagining artificial intelligence would be?
Well, I mean, the word for it comes with dragon, naturally speaking, where it can understand your spoken word. Is that artificial intelligence?
Well, in the AI community, in the artificial intelligence community, there's something that's called a Turing test.
I forget
exactly the definition of the Turing test, but basically a Turing machine...
Well, the basic idea...
Yeah, is
no.
The,
no, basi- no, the basic idea is that you would sit in here, or somebody here, it could be anybody, would sit in here on a computer, and in another room, there would be either a computer program or a person who is answering questions that the person who is in this room is, which this person is asking. So the person in this room, the human being, is trying to figure out by asking questions whether the entity at the other end of the computer is a computer or a real person. Mm.
So far, they haven't been able to do that, from what I understand.
They're
always 10 years away.
Give me an example of questions that are fair to ask.
You could ask any question.
How did you feel when your mother died?
You could ask any question.
And the computer would
and the computer could lie. I mean, there is always a possibility that the computer could lie.
Well, the computer would have to lie.
But the point is, could the computer so accurately simulate human behavior that it would be indistinguishable from a human being?
But every human being is unique, so how
Oh, I can say words about that. I have a bipolar computer on my network.
You have a bipolar
computer. I have a printer hater computer. He has some real personal
issues.
This brings up the question of our tradition of anthropomorphizing machines. This issue of whether you can treat a machine like a person was settled on the Dukes of Hazzard with the General Lee. You know, the 69 Dodge Charger. If there was ever a third member of that group.
Well, that's what people have argued. People have said, well, it doesn't matter if computers are persons or aren't persons. The fact of the matter is we will treat them as persons. And because we will treat them as persons, they will, by that fact, be persons. So
I think we have a tendency to do that, but with lots of things.
But you were just saying, what are the implications of this for abortion or euthanasia? So if we're going to argue that you're a living being because you're capable of rationality, then you're not a living being if you're not.
No, I didn't say a living being. I said a person. I would make a distinction between persons and things that are living.
All right.
Because bugs are living, but I don't think they're persons.
What would you consider the computer? Are you talking, if this computer is a living, does it have rights? Are we talking?
Well, I don't think that
certainly not the monitor. The monitor's nothing. We're talking the little box. We're talking the chips. What are we talking about?
Well, what's the box without the monitor?
It's the hard drive, really. The hard drive is what's critical.
The hard drive is the whole thing.
I have a question, too. What rights do they have? I mean,
the CPU doesn't matter.
You know what I'm saying? Is that it?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm confused.
Yes. It's a theoretical question.
It's a theoretical question, but let me, here's an example that I use for my students in class. Suppose, and this is not far off. I mean, it's going to sound weird to you all, but it's not. Because you're so backwards. No. Because you've been living under rocks. No. This is not all that far. I mean, we already have artificial lungs. There's a respirator. Mm-hmm. We have pacemakers. We have artificial limbs. Okay? So imagine that my pieces start to be replaced one by one by something that is not naturally occurring. Okay? The Bionic Woman, $6 million Man. Whatever. But now we have all of my neurons start to be replaced one by one. And I am now indistinguishable. I mean, you can't. At what point do I stop being a person? If my personality doesn't change at all, if I'm able to maintain conversations, if my sense of humor stays the same, am I still a person, even though at some point we will have gotten to a point where I am all synthetic? Because what people frequently argue... Well, people have argued that it is certainly not impossible.
Yeah.
That it may not be happening right now, but it is at least theoretically possible. There is nothing that would, nothing in the world that would prevent this from happening. And things are getting very close. I mean, there's a book here written, what's the name of the book? It's called The Age of Spiritual Machines, When Computers Exceed Human Intelligence. And there are already computer programs that are able to create by reading lots of different poets. They create original poetry. By studying art, and they are able to create original art. they are able to write not so great fiction, but probably better than I could. So these sorts of programs are already out there. So it's logically possible. That is to say that there's nothing in the world that will prevent it from happening. But it may just be that we're not very creative or we don't put the right things together.
Well, then what rights are you talking about?
Well, it would be if such a thing could happen to me, where I'm replaced one by one, or we create a cyborg.
See, I think that's a totally different thing. You know, if I knew Jennifer and your parts were replaced one by one, I would definitely think you were the same person.
And so I would have the right to life.
Creating a Borg out of, you know, parts.
Jennifer 2.
Yeah. Would feel different to me.
Why?
It says Acme on the outside.
Well, because I would believe that thing that didn't start as a living flesh kind of thing would have, like, a soul and you know, all those sort of intangibles.
Why not?
Because I can't imagine humans creating something with a soul, whatever that is. You know what I mean?
It seems like
that Jesus died. There you go. There's a right. Did Jesus die for Data?
Well, didn't Jesus say that he has many sheep in many nations?
Yes.
Something like that.
This is the Frankenstein story. It really is.
It seems like a perfect environment to say. Can it die into an S? I mean, because that's really, you have to answer the question that you're posing before you even can discuss the rest of that. I think it seems clearly no.
Why is it clearly no? It certainly isn't clear to me.
Because
and I'm always suspicious when people.
Bible. No,
it doesn't say lots of things in the Bible.
No, it's just.
To take this seriously. We could look back at at least Western human beings' history, and there were times when other human beings were regarded as less than human, with terrible results for those people. And the scary thing is that I think that rights for living things depend upon. They either have people who will sort of selflessly advocate for them, or they rise up and demand rights. And if you think about those things with artificial life, that you're talking about people who have developed a relationship and recognize in their guts that this is a being that I relate to, or they rise up and demand it.
Hell.
Yeah.
Well, a bug doesn't die and go to heaven, I don't think. I mean, does a bug have eternal life? Or could we compare? I mean, I could more easily see computers could become living in your definition, but not persons. I mean, maybe that's very obvious. But.
What do you think is necessary for person? I mean, how would I know if I went to another planet and I bumped into some entity? What sorts of things should I look for to figure out if it's a person or not?
Well, I mean, the classic, you run through the list. I mean, we talked about rationality, creativity. Another one is the ability to conceive a future and act upon it. And the major one is, the other major option is morality. The capacity to treat, to respond to others' needs, or to reciprocate their rights. It's one thing to demand your own rights, it's another thing to acknowledge the rights of another.
So could you go through those a bit more slowly? The first one was?
Rationality.
Rationality.
So you're a human being because you can think.
Or you're a person.
Yeah, you're a person because you can think. Or you're a person because you can be creative, like artistic expression. Or the third one was you're a human being because you conceive, self-consciousness. You know who you are and where you are and where you want to be, where you want to go. So you can conceive the future and act on it. And the fourth is morality, or effort is morality. What it means to be human is you transcend instinct and can choose the good or the ill.
But then a fetus would not be a human.
Well, and let me make a distinction between persons and human beings. Human beings, let's reserve that title for the species Homo sapiens. Okay, that's a genetic, biological category. Let's reserve person for having rights like the right to life and the right to choose and that sort of stuff. Okay. Now, not all things. Many people will argue that animals have rights, but very few will argue that animals are persons, because they'll say that animals don't have certain things that are necessary to be persons. And one thing that's frequently talked about in terms of a necessary condition for being a person is having self-awareness. That if you don't have self-awareness, then you're really not a person. But let me make those distinctions. What do you think of the four criteria that Jim's put forth?
What about the capacity to feel and have emotions like love or hatred or something like that? I think of that as a human.
Yeah. But that's necessary because there are some folks.
I think it's as necessary as some of those.
Okay, so do you think that somebody who did not have that capacity or those capabilities wouldn't be a person?
Well, no, somebody in a coma would be a person, but that's because we already think, you know what I mean? I would have more trouble thinking that a human created, whatever you want to call born.
I'm thinking of a sociopath, because sociopaths apparently don't have any sort of emotions, and that's part of the problem.
Well, what if they're totally repressed?
But apparently sociopaths have no feelings. It's not simply that they're repressed. They apparently have no feelings.
It's a damaged person. We have most of it.
Right.
I guess what I'm saying by that is that we give a lot of latitude to people who are...
Things that look like us.
...who are human. Just because we know what most humans are like, or the humans that we understand are like, so that if somebody's in a coma, we say they're a human, or somebody's
species
a sociopath. Yeah, kind of. It's a species.
But isn't that sort of biased? Saying, yeah. Well, you look a lot like me, so I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt.
I'm not saying that's what I think. I'm just saying that, you know, that's one idea. But I get stopped at the everything else is created by, you know, either sprung out. Evolved or whatever, or was created by God or something, or was left anyway. We all experience it as being not created by us. And now it's starting to, I mean, it's getting a little more shaggy now because, you know, there's Dolly, the sheep, and other things. But when you talk about something that, I don't know, yeah, I guess that's kind of where I balk at it, is that something that we created, how could it be life? Because I don't think humans can create life. But then again, I get stopped by you when you say,
how do you define
life?
Right, so how do you define life?
Is mortality a factor here? Is that one of the essences of being a human?
Mortality, capacity.
Well, the example that I use with my students just is angels. If angels did exist, they're probably the sorts of things that don't die, at least if touched by an angel is true. thank you, those of you who watched. I'm counting on it. Those folks don't die, so are they not persons?
They're not persons.
So they don't have rights?
They have names.
Well,
they don't need rights.
They don't need rights.
Look at the big guy. Look at
that.
So nothing could be done wrong to them because they have no rights.
Well, sure, things could be done wrong to them, but it just wouldn't have any case for appeal.
Well, we wouldn't be doing anything wrong if they didn't have a right that it not be done. I mean, I can.
Like, try and imagine something wrong being done to an angel.
What? Okay, well, okay. I mean, what I'm trying to think of is suppose there were some being that was immortal, okay? If you've watched Highlander, or, I mean, there are a bunch of TV shows where there are beings, and I'm sure that you can all conceive of this, of a being who has rationality, who has self-awareness, who has compassion, has all these other things, but won't ever die. Does that mean that that entity wouldn't be a person?
It's not a person. It might be an entity that is worthy of respect? Is that, I mean, because that's not a person, a species thing, or are you taking it outside?
No, human being is a species thing. So person...
Person is?
It's like God, me.
What?
We distinguish between person and human being.
Right, person and human being is a distinction. Oh, so some people have argued that if Klingons exist, they're persons. Okay. If Martians exist, they're persons. That some of the higher primates might be persons, even though they're not human beings, they could still be persons that have rights.
According to my argument, such as it is, if angels were created by God, then they're not human created.
No, they're not human created.
But they're persons. Sorry.
But would they be persons? And I was just responding to the mortality argument.
Oh, okay.
Question.
Or question.
It wasn't our argument.
It was a hypothesis thrown out there. So, I mean, just in terms of really trying to figure out what, and that might be a good example. All things that we consider to have rights do ultimately die. But it doesn't seem to me that it's likely that the ability to die is what's really important about having rights. It seems it's sort of like, oh yeah, and they all die too. But that's not what gives you the rights, what gives somebody the rights.
Well, I'm so curious when you talk about rights, like within computers. And you're talking about the computers that can, if they're fed enough poetry, you can create poetry. Now, when we talk about their rights, are we talking about their rights to have copyrighted poetry created? Are we talking about their rights to not have their plug pulled? Or what kind of rights are we talking about?
It could be the right to not have one's plug pulled. It could be the right, if you read any Isaac Asimov, one of the things he talks about in some of his stories is that these robots shouldn't be sacrificed. They shouldn't be destroyed just for the heck of it. That you should respect these beings because they have autonomy, they have the ability to choose, and they shouldn't be forced to do things that they think aren't right. So in the same way that it would probably be wrong to force me into a career that I don't want to be doing, if we got to a point where computers had consciousness, were able to think, were to have moral opinions, and they had a moral objection to doing something, would it be wrong to force, say, well, I'm sorry, you're a computer, you're going to do this anyway? Those are the sorts of rights. I mean, and yes, it is very fantastic, but the flip side of this in terms of talking about computers is talking about animal rights. It's not a coincidence that I brought up the whole idea of gorillas having rights. Because what this really challenges is our human-centered vision of what sorts of things are persons. And if we start to open it up, the tendency is to let all the things in that we want to let in. We end up letting in other things that we don't want to let in. And if we close off all of our definitions so that we don't let all of these things that we're certain aren't persons in, we end up closing out a lot of other people. So it's really difficult to get definitions where we get to maintain all of the categories that we currently have. Mm-hmm. That as we look at this stuff and we push ourselves, it seems as if we're going to have to take some things from one category where we say that they do have rights or they don't have rights, and we'll have to shift them into the other category where they don't or do. Does that make sense? So what all of these issues do is they really push us to figure out, well, what do we really mean by a person? What do we really mean by life? And in terms of the questions about life, I mean, we talk about, I mean, obviously animals, people, but we talk about viruses being alive. We talk about ecosystems being alive. And so very quickly, if we're going to talk about these things being alive, well, there are computer viruses that act very much like your standard biological virus. Are those things also alive? What does that mean? And I think it really pushes us. And for me, what's most important, I mean, it's fun to sort of play with people's minds and get you all thinking about this, but my concern is, to torment you, is the folks who are doing research in these areas. because I would like those folks to be really thinking about what are the ethical issues as you're as they're trying to develop all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the next step then is a theory of value. How do you decide? You know, if we're willing to acknowledge that other creatures have rights and thus have value, does that mean that all creatures have equal value?
Right.
Environmental ethics, that's called biotic egalitarianism. And I doubt, you know, when you smack that mosquito that you thought twice about whether, in fact, its life was of equal value as yours. So then you still aren't much further down the road. I mean, you still have to start dealing with that question, and then you start getting right back into all the anthropocentric issues about, well, how do we decide what is valuable? Do human beings get to decide what is valuable because certain things are valuable to us? But the fact that a bat steers by radar isn't just as important as our ability to, I don't know, what's unique to us, to be...
Sewers.
Sewers.
Laughter, probably.
Pardon?
With laughter.
Laughter,
that's
all right.
Fairly unique to human beings.
Humor, yeah. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, because if you ask the different species, they're going to say, no, they run far too slow to be persons. You know, they can't fly. They can't possibly be persons.
No hair.
You talk about, what were you talking about? Pulling the plug. What about these dead computers that gave the Chinese all the information they got?
Well,
those computers don't have artificial intelligence yet. I mean, we're sort of far off now. But if my computer on my desk starts talking to me and I can't figure out how somebody might have put some sort of weird program on it and I become convinced that, in fact, my computer is talking to me and says, please, Jennifer, don't unplug me.
There's probably some dedication.
Yeah, probably going to happen.
My computer says every morning, nice software.
Does it really?
We have this news that talks to us a lot. I just have a question.
We open late, the blue says, where have you been?
Really?
Cool. Or if you don't use it for a while, it'll say, well, at least empty the wastebasket.
And it's a 1984 computer.
Matt, right?
Yeah. What? These programs. I mean, I can't imagine that a computer is this intelligent yet, but these programs that teach foreign languages and they correct your pronunciation, is that just the program is able to do it because you're not saying it exactly like it has been the program doing?
I don't know how those things work, but what is interesting, and I was looking for a cartoon that I have here and I can't find it, but what for a long time people kept saying, well, fine, yes, the computer can do this, 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 and this, but it'll never be able to do this, 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 and this. And if it could do this, then it would be a person. But what we found is that every time someone says, but a computer could never be able to do this, 5 years later, it's able to do it. And voice recognition and just the sort of thing that you're talking about has been one of the things that people said, computers will never be able to talk. They'll never be able to correct pronunciation. They'll never be able to recognize facial expressions. And that it can do that now. I mean, there will soon be a point where you can sit in front of a computer and the computer will be able to tell better than another human being if you're happy, sad, angry, etc. And computers can beat people in chess now. I mean, so it's really interesting, but I think one of the things that it does is it really starts to push us to say, well, what really is important? And what some people have said is that what people who have challenged computers have focused on is the really super spectacular things that human beings can do. But what we ought to be focusing on instead are the really mundane things that human beings can do. Because if we think of all of the really smart and brilliant things that we can do, well, computers are probably going to be able to match that. But some of the more difficult things for a computer would be like picking up I'm trying to think of some of the standard examples.
Just walking. To get a robot to walk in anything like a normal method, I don't think they come close to that.
But I think that they could get there.
Yeah, that could get there. I'm trying to think of what the examples were. But just the... I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but just the very mundane human things, like getting irritated at something. So people have started to talk about, well, maybe we've been focusing on the higher aspects of humanity and asking computers to match that. Maybe what's most essential about human beings is our really nastiness, and computers could never match that, which is just sort of a, well, do we really want to go with that argument?
To figure out the most efficient, to take a map, five cities or more, figure out the most efficient way with mileage to get to visit all the cities. It's an interesting problem with computers. You add another city and you've increased it by several orders of magnitude, and they can't do it for more than three or four cities. But a human being can look at a map and make all sorts of estimations.
Right.
The programs that you've seen can't do that, but that's a trivial matter for a computer to do.
No, it isn't.
Properly programmed.
It isn't. Every time that you can't, no computer has ever finished a program in 10 cities.
But this chess game, that's all programmed. I mean, every move had to be programmed in, right? Every possibility.
No. You just have to.
No, they start weighting certain. They have come up with criteria for goodness of a particular move.
Well, what they do is they're able to project all the future possible moves.
And then they prune.
And then see what is going to lead to the best outcome.
They also have computers that can learn now, too.
Right. And that's the really neat thing, is computers that can actually learn. So it's not that the computer is just doing what it's been programmed by a human being to do, but the computer's been programmed to learn. And so the computer then almost begins to write its own programs and then follow its own programs. It's something along those lines. And that's where the artificial intelligence is going to happen.
John Howard Yoder would ask whether a computer would be willing to go to the cross. We talked about pacifism. Would it be possible for a computer to do something that isn't rational or isn't in its self-interest?
Choose to pull its plug.
No, to lay its computer life down for
another computer.
Yeah, no, pulling its own plug for no other reason would be suicide.
Right.
In this case,
for our talk.
Yeah.
Well, this author argues, I mean, he calls it the age of spiritual machines. I mean, he talks in his book about the point at which computers will begin to have
souls,
spiritual quests. Yeah. And so, I mean, I think that he would argue, yeah, sure. Because we can get, because he, what people who are in artificial intelligence argue is, look, human beings are basically computers. We are made up of hardware. We have been coded by our DNA. If you pay any attention to science, we're just extraordinarily complex, but we are built of stuff.
We're organic computers.
Right.
Chemical processes.
Chemical and organic.
To
synthetic.
Well, yeah, or what do you call it when a disk drive moves? Mechanical.
Yeah.
Aren't those computers mechanical?
We're fairly mechanical, though, too.
Yeah.
We are fairly mechanical.
But there actually is movement in the artificial intelligence area into organic computers as well.
Reproducibility is the interesting question.
What's that?
Reproducibility of the, build a clone in intelligence and have.
Well, see, that's what's going on.
Copies of the same intelligence.
Moved.
With organic people.
Well, see, what's happening in the artificial life stuff is that they've been able to create, what they do is they have a basic algorithm, and then they just let it run on the computer. And they end up with things that they never would have predicted. And these things actually do reproduce. They create parasites. I mean, so you start to get this small ecosystem on the computer, and it's all based on an algorithm. That starts everything out. And some of the interesting things that's been going on in natural biology is that much of what's going on in the biological world is also based on algorithms. That at base, there's just some basic scientific and mathematical laws that are basically directing everything. If you look at the evolution patterns between animals on the Australian continent and animals elsewhere, and what's interesting is that Australia as a continent was separated from all the other continents, and so all of the animals there had to evolve on their own, you get animals that are very similar to each other, even though they have different environments and they're not related to one another, but they've all gone towards the same direction. And so people have argued that there are some basic biological laws that will lead things to go towards the same place, so these sort of basic algorithms, and that we can mimic that on computers, and we can get reproduction, we can get patterns out of chaos. And so, I mean, so it's a really interesting area right now, and I think it has lots of ethical questions that aren't being brought up by the people who are working in this area. We are woefully out of time. So thank you all. Joel?
It will satisfy your every need. What will you do when they tell you, in the words of Dietrich Bonhoeffer,